This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome a longtime returning guest back to the show. This is maybe the sixth or seventh time he's been on the show, and that is Mr. Harry Dent. He's founder of Dent Research. He's editor of the free newsletter Economy and Markets, and the author of the new book, Zero Hour, Turn the Greatest Political and Financial Upheaval in Modern History to Your Advantage. And of course, Harry's the author of many books. I've been following his work since maybe 1996, I want to say. Harry, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, nice to be back, Jason.
It's good to have you. You are in Puerto Rico, and you went through quite an ordeal last year. I know you moved to New York for a couple of months, so glad you're okay. And we're happy to have you back. And while everybody's freezing in the Northeast, you're nice and warm.
We're finally looking good after all of this. I had to hold my windows and doors from blowing out. That's how bad it was here. But yeah, now with everybody freezing, we would never know it happened here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Harry, I know you track, and this is a little, you know, we'll get into the economy, real estate market, GOP tax reform. We got a bunch of stuff to talk about, your new book. But I know you, interestingly, you track some kind of, to some academics and economists, you track a couple of sort of, I don't know if it's fair to say, but kind of off the wall or non-mainstream things. And one of them is sunspots. You know, there's all this talk about global warming. Of course, it's freezing because it's warming. That's the kind of logic you hear. It's weird. But what's the whole thing with sunspots? Tell us about that.
Okay, first of all, people think this is weird stuff. The Farmer's Almanac lives by this stuff, and they predicted a cold winter this year just on this. We're at the low end of a sunspot cycle. These things, the sun gets warmer about every 4 or 5 years and then colder every 5 to 6 years to follow, a 10 to 11 year cycle on average. And it's just, you know, sunspots. And the theory is that the pull of bigger planets like Jupiter or Saturn caused this to happen. Nobody knows exactly how, but it does affect solar radiation. I mean, the sunshine and the energy we get from the sun can be 20% higher or lower at the top or bottom of the cycle. Rainfall is also higher when there's higher sun because there's more evaporation and then therefore more rainfall. This is a big deal, but it also affects human beings. I mean, if you just think about people living in a cloudy, foggy place like Seattle, well, they have high suicide rates because without sun, you don't feel good.
Yeah, of course.
Without energy, you don't feel good. And so it also affects investor psychology and business and everything. And so this is a cycle that I've documented back 170 years, I think. Mm-hmm. The recessions happen 88% of the time in the downside of this sunspot cycle. And the worst financial crises in history, 11 out of 11 back to the early 1800s, have 100% happened in the downside of the sunspot cycle. And we're in the downside of a sunspot cycle since 2014. And it will bottom around 2020, give or take. And again, these things, this is not as clock-like as some cycles, but scientists can track and predict this. And they're saying this thing would peak by late 2013. They were only a few months off, and they're saying it should bottom by the early to mid part of 2020. So this is saying, number one, this winter being so cold is not unexpected. At the bottom of a sunspot cycle, things are going to be colder than warmer. But for the economy, most of the worst recessions have come into the downside of this cycle. And guess what the last downside of this cycle was? 2008, 2009.
Pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, the Great Recession. So this is serious stuff. I get so much flack.
Yeah.
I've had people who read my books and subscribers in my newsletter say, Harry, you can't talk about this stuff. I mean, I'm saying, what do you mean? This isn't astrology or something. Yeah. This is really clear scientific stuff.
Yeah, and it
works, and it works all throughout history.
Your friend Bob Prechter, who's been on the show before, he's a really interesting guy, Elliott Wave theory stuff.
Yeah.
And he talks about how people in the economy, you know, they share their emotions with each other. And certainly that has an effect on things. I mean, listen, if it's gloomy all the time, you're not going to be as optimistic. Arguably, that's why, you know, sort of the old, I don't want to say the current version, but the old version of my home state, the Socialist Republic of California, sort of had this, you know, like this optimistic type of mindset.
Yeah, because it's a
you know?
Sunny state, yeah, and yeah. Washington is not. Hey, depressed people don't buy stocks, you know, and don't invest in the future and stuff. So it's not the only factor in the economy, but out of four cycles I've identified over 30 years of research, and I've had to find one after the next. When something I can't explain is coming up, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm missing another important cycle. And that's how I found sunspot cycles. The top mutual fund manager back then at PIMCO was the guy who said, hey, sunspot cycles was the way I averted the 2000-2002 tech crash.
He was saw Bill it Gross? I mean, someone else.
I forget the guy's name, but he was the Bill Gross was the top bond fund manager. This guy was the top mutual fund manager there.
Okay.
And he said, I got out. The sunspot cycle peaked in March of 2000 and then went down. And that's what allowed this guy to get out of the market. He saw this coming, and nobody would have ever seen that coming. So it's a powerful cycle, but it affects a lot of things.
Good stuff.
And it's affecting the weather right now. We're towards the bottom end of a sunspot cycle that's been declining since 2014. But more importantly, the sunspot cycles have been lower at their peaks since the 1960s. And that would go against climate change on the warming side. There is warming from CO2, but there is cooling from these sunspot cycles. So you have to understand both to get the full picture. And when it's too hot, people say, oh, see, global warming. And then when we hear it go cold, people say, oh, there's no global warming.
Yeah,
Come on, folks. No, both camps are wrong. Both are happening.
But if
warming,
cool. But if you want to be right all the time, you just call it climate change.
That's why they switched it from global warming to climate change.
Exactly.
Climate changes, and there are natural cycles that are massive, long-term and short-term. I understand all these cycles because I study cycles. I understand billion-year climate cycles. I mean, there was a time when the Earth froze over totally, and there was a time in the age of the dinosaurs when there was no ice anywhere. That's how extreme natural cycles get. But there's intermediate, you know, and there's shorter term. And right now, the biggest thing people should understand is probably going to get a little colder in the next few years.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It makes good for living in Puerto Rico.
Hey, that federal tax break you have is pretty great, too. Harry, got the new Zero Hour book out. Now, obviously, that was written before GOP tax reform.
Yes.
Which one do you want to talk about first, Zero Hour or tax reform, or blend them together? I'll let you take it.
Yeah, I'll start with tax reform because I've been saying this for over a year in my newsletter. Look, there's a time to cut taxes and stimulate business, and there's a time not to. This is not the time. Businesses have had free money from the Fed, and they've used this to buy back their own stocks and pay higher dividends and do mergers and acquisitions without really investing in expanded capacity and new jobs. All we've done is hire back the people we laid off in the Great Recession, and now we're back at full employment, 4%, give or take. And guess what? Workforce growth, and I'm the demographics guy, I understand this better than anybody. Workforce growth, which is just a combination of young people entering and older people retiring, is very predictable, and it's going to be flat to near down for decades. How are we going to grow with no growing workforce growth? And on top of that, productivity. So if you take growth from workforce and productivity, well, productivity has declined from 2-3% in the past down to 0.5% now on average. And it's going to go to zero or lower because older people in an aging society are less productive. period. So this is also something documented. So we don't have the growth trends we had when somebody like Trump says, oh, if we just lower taxes or we just stimulate more quantitative easing, we're going to grow at 4% again. We're never going to grow at 4% again in this country until we start to double our lifespans or something. And that is possible in the next several decades. But until then, it's not going to happen. So this is a big fake news, I would call it. Oh, the Republicans say, oh, we lowered taxes. Now businesses are going to invest and build more factories and hire more people. No, they're not.
Okay, so my question about that is, okay, we hired, you know, because of the essentially free money that's been flowing into the economy, thanks to, you know, QE and all this soft money policies, companies and individuals, especially the rich, have been able to take advantage of, you know, free borrowed money. You could even argue negative interest rates, I guess.
Yeah.
And that has been a huge stimulus.
A stimulus for wealth, not a stimulus for the average worker whose wages have been going sideways to down since 2000.
Right.
It hasn't helped them because they don't have the money to invest and take advantage.
Well, no, I agree. It always helps the rich. I mean, no question. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely agree with you.
But if the rich invest in new plants and new jobs, then it does trickle down to Homer Simpson. This is not happening because they're not investing. We're at 75% capacity for businesses. 85% is normal. 90% is optimal. We don't need more capacity because we already overinvested in the great boom. And now all this free money goes back to stock buybacks. I've got a chart that shows that the net money coming into the stock market between institutional investors, businesses, and consumer investors, all has come from businesses. Businesses buying back their own stocks.
Right.
This is the greatest BS recovery in history.
Yeah, so I definitely know about the stock buybacks, and I've talked about that a bit on the show. But, you know, I'm curious, what is the real effect of a stock buyback? So this money flows in and you know, many are saying now with tax reform, more money is going to flow in from those offshore accounts and there's going to be a little less incentive to do the double Irish twist and all these complicated schemes these big, you know, companies and the ultra rich are doing. And it's going to flow back on shore. And, you know, the critics would say, well, it's just going to be used for stock buybacks, right? But, you know, let's examine the stock buyback concept for a second. Is there any stimulative effect from that? I mean, the buyback certainly makes the price of the stock go up, but
well who benefits from
what
that?
What else happens?
Homer Simpson or the top 0.1% to 1%?
Not Homer Simpson directly, but
a small percentage of people in this country own almost all the wealth, especially the financial assets. Mm-hmm. So it benefits them, and they're already so rich they don't know how many jets to buy or which yacht to buy or which house and vacation house to buy. This does not help Homer Simpson. And you cannot have an economy where the generals advance without the troops for so long. That's what happened in 1929. The rich got richer and richer and richer off of speculative profits, off of stocks and real estate and stuff until the economy imploded. And that's going to happen again because it always happens. Everybody's got to move together. And that's what's not happening here. And hey, I'm in the top 0.1% to 1%. I shouldn't be complaining about this.
I know. I am too, and I'm complaining about it.
I know that it's dangerous when this happens.
I agree. I definitely do not want to live in a banana republic, even if I'm in the elite class, because it's no fun. It's too unstable. There's too much crime. It's just not good for humanity and innovation. It's not good for anything. We could all move, even if we're not, you know, really rich in the top 1%, we could all move to some third world country and live like kings, right? In Queens.
Yes.
But, you know, nobody's really doing that in any real significant way, obviously.
I would consider Thailand and Bali because I've been to both those places recently. And man, it's a high quality of living if you have money. And my gosh, your money goes five times as far.
Right. Well, you know, there's a few, but it's on the fringes. Yeah.
You know, Uruguay, probably not.
How about Venezuela? I hear they're doing well.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that sad? Socialism is a disaster. But Harry, you know, I mean, when you said, you know, the rich are buying the yachts and the jets and stuff like that, but I mean, somebody's building those yachts and jets. There's a zillion parts suppliers. You know, there's people that maintain them. I mean, I don't know. You know, this is that old argument, we live in a consumption-based world. It's like if you don't have growth, the whole thing falls apart. You got to have growth, and you can argue about externalities and how it's bad for the environment and so forth, for sure. No question. But it does trickle, right?
But it trickles less when the growth is all going to the top 1%. And I tell you, Jason, it's really the top 0.1%.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question.
That's where it's really at. The one out of 1,000 households that control 25% of the total wealth in the country versus the top 1% that control 50%. That one-tenth of that 1% controls as much wealth as all the other 0.9%. So that's where it's at. And that does not trickle down as much because those people save and invest more and they buy certain things. And yes, they fuel certain industries like yachts or whatever, or high-end housing, but they don't fuel the everyday economy. You cannot have an economy where the rich keep getting richer and the everyday person falls behind. And that ends in revolution. And that's what my book is about.
Yeah.
Zero Hour. It's about, look, we've come to the point like in the 1700s where we had the American Revolution and the French Revolution stuff where trends got so extreme that the everyday people started revolting against the rich and the people in power, the Americans versus the British and the peasants versus the lords and France and stuff. And this happens, I mean, and because free market capitalism does reward the people who contribute the most. And that's a damn good thing from my point of view. But every trend can go to extremes. And, you know, democracy includes everybody, and democracy can go to extremes where everybody's got such a free lunch that nobody's working anymore.
Well, yeah, you get the tyranny of the majority.
At the same time. We're having all of this. We've got an entitlement situation in countries which is not even remotely sustainable with a smaller millennial generation at peak levels coming in the coming decades to support a dying and retiring baby boom generation that's been promised everything and, you know, policemen to get $100,000 a year for life and stuff. This is just not possible. I mean, any moron with a calculator could tell you that there's no way these things can be paid. But economists say, oh, yeah, but if we grow at 4% and if inflation is 1% and if blah, 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 all these things, it can work out. None of these projections have any merit whatsoever. I look at reality. I look at demographics. I look at economic cycles. And we don't always grow at 4%. We grow at 3 to 4% in booms, and then we decline 0 to 1 to 2% in downturns. Nobody takes into account the downturns like 1929 to 1942 or 1973 to 1982. Nobody takes into account those things. We do. These entitlements we have are totally unsustainable, and there's only one simple answer to it among many. We have to retire later because we're living much longer and we never adjust our entitlement.
I know. It's been 65 since people lived an average of like 4 years after they turned 65.
Exactly.
And now they're living 30 years.
That's what they live. Yeah. They only lived a few years.
Yeah. The whole
now
thing doesn't work.
Now people live to 84.
It's ridiculous.
They live
yeah.
to 65.
Totally. Totally. And they're pretty vital. You know, the health span has gotten much better. It's not just the lifespan. It's the health span. A lot of older people are much more engaged and living much more productive, healthy lives, you know.
Work longer? I'm 64 going on 65. Yeah. I'm supposed to retire next year.
Nah, it's crazy.
Should I retire? Are you kidding?
Nuts. Yeah, nuts.
It doesn't make any sense. And if I did, I'd be bored to death.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Okay, so Harry, let's talk a little bit about some of the technologies, and I believe you talk about this in your book. Why won't some of these, you know, largely hyped technologies, and I don't want to say hyped in that they're not real, because they are, and I talk about them a lot, but, you know, there's a lot of talk about them. Self-driving cars, 3D printing, AI, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, blockchain, you're saying that these aren't going to really start to pay off for quite a while, like 13 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's like automobiles or electricity or anything like that. They take decades to move into just the niche markets. And then when they really prove themselves and come down in cost, when Henry Ford's all of a sudden producing Model Ts for a tenth of the cost and paying his workers, $5 an hour instead of $1 an hour, that's when things take off. And that's when they make a difference. So there's always innovation. So when I talk to people like George Gilder or technology experts, they'll say, oh, Harry, there's always innovation and innovation's exponential. I said, I know innovation's exponential. I've studied history, but it's when those exponential innovations come together and move on an S-curve, which is the most exponential, into the mainstream from 10% to 90% of the public in a matter of a few decades, that's when the world changes. That's when everybody uses automobiles and electricity and phones to move to suburbs instead of living in crowded, smoggy cities. And that's when everything explodes. We've already seen that with the internet. We've already seen globalization hit its peak. We've already seen you can get on your iPhone and contact anybody and talk about anything and buy anything. That's already peaked. Everybody's got that in the developed world. So it's going to take a while for nanotechnologies and biotech and things like that and 3D printing. Those are longer term technologies that can make a big difference, especially biotechnology. If we could live to 100 to 120 instead of 70 to 80, in the world, that would change the demographic decline, which I can project forever is bad. Well, that would change if we were in the workforce twice as long because we lived much longer. And that is going to happen by some longer term cycles I study. It's just a matter of when. And we have a 45-year innovation cycle that says, look, the time for that to happen would be 2032 to 2055. That's still a ways away. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're going to have to wait on that, and we're going to have to deal with slowing demographics around the world, which will get better in a lot of ways several years from now. But we're going to have to deal with slowing demographics and productivity until these technologies take us to the next level, like the internet did and like automobiles did before that and railroads before that and steamships. I mean, steamships changed the world. Railroads changed the world. And all commerce and how we worked and the assembly line along with automobiles, that's the type of stuff. We're seeing still a lot of innovations, but it's not going to hit for another 10 years or so.
The excitement is premature, in other words, on some of these technologies, is your opinion.
I mean, driverless cars, it's going to reduce as many jobs as it creates.
Oh, Uber, yeah, transportation Uber is one of the biggest employers in the world.
Create better things, but these things are not going to expand our economy like the internet did or TVs and automobiles did. They're going to make it more efficient, which is also a good thing. I'd be an investor in all these technologies. I'd be an investor in blockchain. Blockchain is just going to make the internet more efficient and secure for financial transactions. That's a big deal, but it's not as big as the internet itself. Google and email tripled the productivity of my business at a minimum, tripled. Yeah. There's no way that blockchain will triple the productivity of what I do in research.
Yeah, interesting stuff, interesting stuff. You know, Harry, I first became attracted to your work in the mid to late 90s because it seemed like demographics are almost 100% reliable. You know when people are going to hit 46 years old, when the bulk of that curve is going to hit 46, the peak spending time, or whatever age is the peak income time. You know, those aren't exactly equal, by the way. They're a little bit off. But what's interesting is that, you know, like, for example, you were years ago like the god of Wall Street. Every financial planner was quoting you and they were saying, you know, be in the market. And then in 2010, we think the market's going to take a dump because the retiring baby boomers are going to pull money out of the stock market, become more conservative. And then you also talked about how they're going to sell their McMansions and, you know, that'd be
But the biggest thing is spending less. Spending drives the economy.
Yeah. But the thing that's interesting, I mean, argue with me if you want about this, feel free. But, you know, a lot of that stuff didn't really happen. And of course, the thing is, you can't really predict it just with demographics, because you don't know what the Fed's going to be doing at that time. You don't know what the monetary and fiscal policy will be. You don't know what the technology will be. I mean, it's just, it's really, the prediction business is tough, you know?
Yeah. You're right, though, that the wild card is the governments and the monetary and fiscal policies. We have never had a time in history. I mean, the economy did start to weaken in 2008, as did Japan in the 90s, as we predicted, because of demographic. But government stepped in, especially in early 2009 with quantitative easing, and just flooded the economy with free money.
Yeah, and that's a huge wild card. Yeah.
Compared to a $75 trillion economy. That's like a 20% dividend to everybody. It's like sending everybody a $10,000 check in the mail over time. That really had never happened before. Governments saw that the economy could melt down like the 1930s with excess debt and slowing demographics, everything we've explained in our past books. But I didn't ever think that central banks would just go crazy and just say, well, we'll just replace every dollar with a new dollar. And, you know, hey, that has worked longer and better than I would have ever thought conceivable. But you can't, Jason, live on something for nothing economics. And you know what's happening today? You know the biggest reason the stock market's going up? One thing. Companies are buying back their own damn stocks. That's the greatest BS thing in history. They got so much free money, and now they're going to get lower taxes, free money from lower taxes. And they're just going to keep buying back their stocks. So there's less stocks. So even if they're not growing, the earnings per share is growing. This is only benefits the top 0.1%, which is already off the charts rich compared to any time in history, even now more than 1929. And 1929 led to the greatest depression in history when you got those extremes. This is terrible economics.
And hang on.
3 years from now, I'm going to be a limo driver in Australia and just say, I don't know about anything.
Harry, but hang on a second. On that stock buyback thing, well, there are many effects to that. There are trickling issues and things like that. But one effect that's obvious and immediate is that all those execs who are buying back their stock and companies buying back treasury stock, it makes everybody in that company more committed to the company because they have more at stake now.
Well, no. The executives, the owners, but not the everyday person.
I know that. But what I'm saying is, look at there are wide-ranging effects that I think need to be considered. If they're more committed to the company, then, you know, they're going to work harder to innovate more, to make things better, faster, cheaper.
What? Buy back their own stock. Well, whatever. Pay dividends to their stockholders. They're not expanding their facilities. Companies are at 75% capacity today after this great boom in recovery. 85% is normal. 90% is optimal. They're not expanding their capacity, and they don't need to because the economy, our workforce, is growing at zero.
Yeah.
Productivity is growing at 0.5%.
We definitely need to see real wage increases, which have not happened for decades in any substantial way.
And why? Because all the profits are going to the owners and the investors, not Homer Simpson, the worker. Yeah. And if the workers can't grow with the generals, then eventually they revolt and cut off the heads of the generals and the economy dies. That's why I'm saying we're going to have the biggest revolution in history because the everyday people, and you got to remember, the tax reform just passed by the Republicans. You know what the polls showed the support of the public was? 26%. That's less than Trump's 31% base. The troops are not behind the generals here.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I mean, who is the person in the leadership role basically saying, you know, there's no bread, let him eat cake? Is it Trump? You know, is it all the CEOs? I mean, is it the banking cartel? How serious and significant is that problem, you know?
There is no leadership here. Now, I tell you, though, movements, major revolutions start with populist movements, which start with people like Hitler, and I hate to say it, Trump, who go to the bottom end.
And they extol nationalism.
You're hurting the most, and we're going to make America great again. What did Hitler say in 1933 when he became chancellor, 84 years almost to the day after Trump? And that's a big cycle for us, by the way.
What's the cycle? What do you mean by that?
Germany greater.
What do you mean by that?
84-year innovation cycle.
Okay. Okay.
And populist movement cycle in politics. It's both at the same time. What did Hitler say? I'm going to make Germany great again. Germany failed after World War I, went through hyperinflation and went bankrupt beyond compare, and then hit the Great Depression in the early 30s. Mm-hmm. So what did Hitler say? I'm going to make Germany great again. That's what Trump is saying today. Mm-hmm. Trump is starting a revolution, and it's important. It's kind of good what he's doing. He's shaking up things.
Oh, yeah.
But the revolution does not end up on the conservative, regressive, we're going to go back to the good old days edge. It always ends up in the progressive edge, just like the Civil War. It started with the South, which was more regressive and less progressive than the North, seceding from the Union, saying, we can't stand this progress anymore. And then guess what happened? We got more progress.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting time, no question about it. Well, we will see how it all shakes out. Harry, give out your website and tell people where they can find you.
HarryDent.com. Often you can get our book for free there with a shipping charge. We have a free newsletter, Economy and Markets. It's a daily newsletter. You can get to know us. And then we have paid newsletters and stuff after that. And of course, the book is now available on Amazon, Zero Hour.
Okay, good stuff. Harry Dent, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, HartmanMedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.